Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Cigna Autism Awareness Series Conference. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Lauren Presti. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Kim. Good day, and thank you for calling into Cigna's Autism Awareness Series. My name is Lauren Presti, and I am the lead clinician for the autism team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you will be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding the presentation today. After this survey, you'll be able to ask questions on today's presentation. A handout for today's seminar is available online at www.cigna.com/autism. Scroll to the current topic section in the middle of your page and click on today's topic labeled Talking to Your Child About Autism, When, How Often, and How. Please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more specific information on your policy and if your policy covers topics discussed in today's seminar, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Today, I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Michael Cameron and Dr. Karen Conway. Dr. Cameron is a board-certified behavioral analyst and the Chief Clinical Officer at Pacific Child and Family Associates. Dr. Conway is a licensed clinical psychologist and a board-certified behavioral analyst at the Pacific Child and Family Associates. Michael and Karen, thank you for being here today, and you are welcome to start your presentation.
Thank you for the introduction and for the opportunity, Lauren. On the very first slide for our participants, we outline an agenda for our presentation today. And just briefly, we'll be discussing the reasons for talking about autism with children, some conversational guidelines that we suggest based on our explicit experience in terms of working with families and personally having these conversations with children. We'll also review a pyramid of topics to be discussed and, critically, when to have conversations. We'll also be touching on the implications of theory of mind and what implications it has for these conversations for your family. And then we'll also be discussing the relevance and importance of having conversations under non-emotional states and non-emotional conditions in order to set the foundation for healthy talk and healthy conversations as you move along in terms of the child's development. And then finally, we'll be talking a lot about emphasizing the child's strengths, the need to teach them perspective taking and to provide unconditional care and loving interactions with children. So that's an overview of our presentation for today. I am with, as Lauren mentioned, Dr. Karen Conway, and she and I will move back and forth with respect to our presentation. And I'll cover certain topics and areas, and Karen will do the same. And at times, we will interrupt each other for our own contributions as we move along. So at this point, I'm on the first slide regarding reasons to talk about autism and why it matters. And the first thing that I want to emphasize here is that in our clinical work, for both Karen and I, we work with a very wide range of children and adults, quite frankly, not just children. And many of the individuals that we serve and the families that we work for have children that would fall into the category of being nonverbal. So they may have communication systems in place, such as a picture exchange communication system, or even manual sign language, for example, or they may use assistive technology for the purpose of communicating, but largely individuals that are nonverbal and then may have challenges with respect to their expressive language capabilities and also their receptive language capabilities. That's one end of the continuum. If you slide away from that, then we advance into work with children that are highly verbal, individuals who are essentially at age level from a developmental standpoint. So their verbal capability is rich, you know, no different from mine, no different from yours, no different from Karen's. So one of the first points that I like to make is that conversations about a child's challenges should emanate from the family, needs to be discussed by the family. And I make no assumptions about a child's language capability. I will talk to them in a developmentally appropriate way, but I will talk to them about their challenges, talk to them about their struggles, and equally as importantly, talk to them about what their strengths are. So even for me, if a child is nonverbal, my communication just never stops. And that's one of the things that I encourage moms and dads to do as well. Just talk to your child, discuss the struggles, discuss just exactly how you will support them. And I recognize as well as anybody else that when you do not have a back and forth exchange with a child, having those conversations and talking to a child like that can be difficult. But I maintain that it's essential not to make assumptions about the child's language capacity and to indicate to that child what their strengths are and how you're going to support them with respect to challenges. And I also believe that this communication begins and always stays with the family and should be ongoing during the child's entire development.
Hi, this is Dr. Karen Conway, and I would like to add to what Michael has stated. A lot of parents ask, why do I need to tell my child he or she has autism or has any kind of diagnosis or is different from any other child that he or she is growing up with? And there are several responses to that very important question, which will be addressed throughout this entire presentation. But what I'd like to start with is by not talking about something that's critically important and obvious within a family, you're keeping a secret. And secrets can be very damaging, and especially in the big picture, and can cause a lot of problems down the line when the child becomes older. And keeping a secret within a family is much, much more stressful than just talking openly and honestly with words that you as parents are comfortable using with your child, whatever their developmental level may be. So first and foremost, the thing that you don't want to do is keep a secret. And I think we'll touch more on that as we go forward, Michael.
We will. And one of the other things that we need to acknowledge here as well is that the conversation is so necessary by families. However, Karen and I work with very diverse families. We have families who are Vietnamese, families that are Korean, families that are Indian, families that are Armenian, and many times the initial conversation that we need to have is with the family, because there's got to be agreement among family members that this conversation will occur. And we just can't stress the importance of laying the groundwork first. And that is, you know, for mom and dad not to just take the lead independent of the family network, but to have a pre-conversation with the family and to come to some pre-agreement that this is what will be done and here are the reasons why it will be done. And that can be very difficult. And it can be influenced by culture, influenced by religion, and influenced by family circumstances. So one of the first takeaway points that we'd really like to make is, as Karen mentioned, not to keep secrets, but also to ensure that there's some pre-conversation that occurs with critical family members and even extended family members, grandmothers and grandfathers, aunts and uncles, and siblings as well, about the decision to do this. And then at that point, moving into the process speaking to the child with the diagnosis.
And, Michael, I'd like to add one thing to that. In a number of families that I've worked with, one partner, one spouse, whether it be the husband or the wife, agrees that it is important to talk to their child about some of their challenges that they're facing, whereas the other partner or spouse disagrees. So the first thing that needs to happen within a family is that the two partners, whether it be a husband and wife, whoever it is that's raising the child, communicate between themselves as to when to have this conversation, whether or not to have it, why to have it, how to have it. And it's kind of difficult, I think, to speak to a population at large as we are right now, but I can tell you that in my experience, many times one parent wants to talk to the child, the other doesn't, and so it's decided that the one parent who does want to have this conversation with the child does it and is the primary speaker with regard to this topic, whereas the other partner may step back and just be available for support. So it's very important to figure out what your comfort level is with regard to how you're going to provide this information, because children, regardless of their age, regardless of their ability or disability, pick up on a parent's temperament, on their demeanor, on their mood. And so if the parent providing this information is comfortable with it and has already spoken to their partner, it just makes it that much easier for this conversation to go forward in a smooth manner.
One of the things that we often do, and I'll just use a recent example, I'm currently working with an Armenian family where this issue is playing out right now. And one of the things that we've done is to provide support to the family by putting a person in place that has a nice rapport with the mom and dad, and that person is functioning as a mediator in terms of discussing the advantages and the disadvantages of having this conversation with their young son. So the conversation has to be at the level of the family, and I know I'm repeating myself here, but it's important, but at the level of the family, and sometimes a third person that's really outlining all the advantages and the disadvantages of doing it needs to be put in place to have, you know, a real authentic conversation with the mom and dad and other extended family members if required. One of the other things I'd like to point out, and I'm still on the slide in terms of reasons to talk about autism, but I'm in the educational component in that box. Just as we would with a child with other forms of challenges. For example, in my career, I've done a lot of work with children with health problems, children that have been burn victims, for example, and have been hospitalized at Shriners Hospital in Massachusetts. I've also worked with a number of children with the diagnosis of diabetes, juvenile diabetes. And here's the point. Just as we would take a child like that and talk to them in the first case about the accidents that had occurred and in terms of the burns and then, you know, how we would care for that child, just as we would discuss with a child about their diabetes and what effect diabetes has on their little body, and what effect food has on their body, and what effect, you know, varying levels of blood sugar levels have on their body. Just as it's important to speak to them about their challenges and how it impacts them, it is equally important to talk to a child about autism and then how it impacts them as well. So we do this in so many other areas. You know, for children with medical problems or emotional problems, for example, a child that's adopted or a child that's a foster child, we're constantly having conversations about what it means to have those challenges, what those challenges look like, and how we will support them. So the next takeaway point that we want to make is the conversation needs to occur. It should be pre-agreed among the family that it will occur, and it's educational in nature, and that is the intent of it. We're moving to the next slide on conversation guidelines.
Interestingly, the family as a whole really decides the guidelines. And, you know, just as each family is unique, so are your guidelines. The most important thing I think you want to try to do is match your language to your child's development, to your child's developmental age. And with that having been said, you don't need to come right out and say, for example, Johnny, you know, you have a lot of struggles keeping your body calm and telling us what you want, and that's because you have this thing called autism. You don't have to be that blunt. You can kind of lead in to this conversation, and as you become more comfortable, the language that you use can change according to where you are in that conversation with your child. A lot of children who have typically developing language skills, who can have a conversation just as we are right now, might come to you and say something like, why did tutors come to my house and work with me? My friends that I go to school with don't have those kinds of tutors. That's a great segue for you to talk openly and honestly with your child about being autistic. And you can start from the beginning and tell like a little story, like a bedtime story almost, about how when your child was growing up, you noticed that he or she was really good at playing with certain toys. And, for example, one of the children I worked with loved cars and trucks. All he wanted to do was play with cars and trucks, but he didn't really play with them the way that other children did. He was more interested in spinning their wheels and watching the wheels spin than he was in creating maybe a little social scenario where the car would leave the driveway and it would, you know, go to the racetrack and race with other, you know, race car drivers. And so you can use these kinds of examples to point out to your child what strengths he or she has and what they're good at and also what they've struggled with. And that this was the time in their life when you realized that something wasn't going the way that it might be going for other children at the same age. And so you went to the doctor, and you can use the pediatrician's name that you use. Try to always use familiar words and names with your kids when you have these kinds of conversations. And just let the story unfold naturally. And you can talk about how, you know, maybe you were referred through your insurance company to an agency that had, you know, John came over and Susan came over and they helped you to play with your car so that now when you're at school, you know how to race your cars with your friends. And you can just, you know, go on in a natural kind of story fashion using real-life experiences and situations that your child may or may not remember. And, again, as Michael said, you want to have this conversation frequently and often. And then you can simply work the word autism into the conversation because you don't want to hide it. Remember, that's a burden to you and the family. And you can use the word autism just as freely as you could use the word allergies or low blood sugar level or asthma. You know, just if you're natural about it and it seems comfortable to you, that's what your child will pick up on. And I think that's probably one of the most important things that we can impart here today is if you're comfortable with it, then that's how your child's going to perceive it and that's how he's going to feel about it.
Yeah, that's great, Karen. using developmentally appropriate language that is meaningful and impactful to the child and is really consistent with the way you talk in the first place is the absolute way to go. The other thing that I want to add here, and I'm just a firm believer in this, you know, we're talking right now about discussing autism with the child and challenges. It's equally important to always discuss with them what their strengths are, mm-hmm. who they are as people, and what their strengths are. I'll tell you a little story about a boy. His name is David, and he has a diagnosis of autism, and he's 9 years old. And David has a high level of sensitivity to especially unpredictable sounds. So the sound of a vacuum cleaner, for example, or if his mom and dad are in the kitchen and they turn on the coffee grinder, or if they turn on the blender, for example, David essentially panics. And it's evident that he's panicking because his blood pressure will go up, his little heart will start racing, and he's legitimately fearful under those circumstances. This is something that David did that I find truly remarkable. He started to go on YouTube, and he began looking up videos of blenders and coffee grinders and vacuum cleaners. And he pulled them up on YouTube, and he self-adjusted the volume. So he turned it down, and he listened to the vacuum cleaners, and he listened to the coffee grinders, and he listened to the blenders, and he did it under his own control. That is just a remarkable strength. Nobody ever told him to do that. Nobody ever encouraged him to do that. He just self-initiated that entire process. He's also a little kid with some very, very good computer skills, and that's not true for all the children we serve. But he happens to have some very good skills in that area. And this is something that we talk to him about all the time. You know, David, it's just remarkable. You have such an incredible capability to really problem solve on your own and to take control on your own in terms of these things in your own home, in your own kitchen that really frighten you. So the point here, the next takeaway point that I'm trying to make is discussing with your child always what their strengths are, what the beautiful things are about them, you know, what they do that makes you laugh, what they do that makes you smile, because it's that balance of talking about them as an individual, their strengths, who they are as people. It's the balance between that and the discussion about their challenges that makes it feel right for all of us. The next thing I want to emphasize, and I'm still on the conversation guideline slide, and I'm at the lower box. It's very helpful, in my experience, to take these conversations and to couple them with other activities. So, for example, it's not uncommon for me to recommend to a family to have the initial conversation or a conversation during something that's really preferred that the child is doing. So, example, walking the dog, playing games, you know, doing something that's enjoyable, jumping on a trampoline. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with kids jumping on a trampoline. You know, you're just standing there with them on the big trampoline, you know, holding their hands and bouncing up and down and having conversations. I often find it very helpful to just couple up the conversation with an activity that's enjoyable to the child, and it's not the conversation that's taking the dominant role. The conversation's occurring, but it's occurring in a situation that the child finds enjoyable. The next takeaway point has to do with what I call threshold, and I never have a conversation with a child, especially initially, for very long. And frankly, it's not like you and I. It's not unlike you and I. You know, there are certain topics that all of us find difficult to have to talk about. And every single one of us in this room right now have been in a situation where somebody starts talking about something and we start squirming, we start becoming uncomfortable, and we just want that conversation to end. And that's because the person has pushed us beyond our threshold. Many times having very short conversations with predictable beginnings and endings is very helpful. So I can have a talk with a child, and it may be for 2 minutes, and that's it. It's done. And then I'll come back to it, and it'll be another 2 minutes, but then it's done. And then it may get longer and longer progressively. But I never push a child beyond their threshold in terms of the conversation. I'm always mindful of what that threshold is for the child, and then I'll back off in terms of the conversation. And I'll bring it to a natural end. I won't end it abruptly. I'll just end it naturally. But I'll always let them know, you know, we'll discuss it a little bit more some other time. So the takeaway points, you know, bring it into a situation that the child is comfortable, not threatened, and a situation that the child may find enjoyable, and then maintaining the threshold.
And, Michael, I'd just like to add one thing to that. You can end your very brief 2-minute conversation with your child by saying something like, if you ever have any questions that you want to ask me about this, feel free anytime. That leaves the door open, and the child knows this isn't a secret. This is something that can be revisited anytime I want to.
Yeah, and that also assumes that the child has the language ability to ask questions. And again, I just want to remind everybody in the room here that we are very aware that many of you have children that are nonverbal, and we'll continue to discuss those individuals as well. But by all means, for a child with good language capacity, you know, children that are age level, or even individuals that are adults. Again, just encouraging the questions and the safety in terms of asking those questions. At this juncture, I'm moving to my next slide, and the label of it is a pyramid of discussion. And I'm going to begin at the base of that pyramid. And one of the things that I want to point out here is that in the beginning, in terms of entering into conversation with children, I typically talk about very specific events that occur. And I'm just going to give you an example of that. It's a boy that I'm currently, I don't work with him. He's a family friend. And he has a diagnosis of autism, and he's 9 years old. And he's somebody that he enjoys text messaging me. And he enjoys phone conversations with me as well. And it was quite humorous because not so long ago, he texted me and said, can you call me? And I said, yes. And as soon as I got on the phone with Ben, he said, Michael, I want to have a 1-hour and 4-minute conversation with you. And I said, Ben, a one hour and 4 minute conversation. I said, that's curious. And by the way, he and his mom and dad and myself have agreed that it was okay for me to talk about situations like this. But that just gave me the opportunity. You know, Ben, why is it that you want to have a 1-hour and 4-minute conversation? And I'm just curious where that comes from. And you know, do you know that, you know, there are different ways of looking at this in terms of having conversations on the phone and not necessarily having rules around just exactly how long, you know, those conversations will last. So this is an example of taking a very specific event, a situation, and using it as an opportunity to discuss with the child the nature of the way they think about things, they view things, and how that connects and links up to their diagnosis of autism, which is something that we do with Ben. Now, another example is a child who's nonverbal. I'll take an opportunity with that kind of child if I'm needing to support them during very dysregulated behavioral states. So, for example, it may be tantrum behavior. So I will tell that child, you know, even before the tantrums occur, talk to that child about how I'll support them, not necessarily in the context of the tantrum, but prior to it occurring, I will let that child know, if this occurs, if you are unsafe or if I feel you're unsafe or it's not a comfortable situation, this is how I will support you. And again, I use age-appropriate language, and I make no assumptions about what the child's understanding or not understanding. I will let them know just exactly what I plan on doing with the other child. So there again is an example of using very specific events to take the opportunity to talk about to a child about how you will support them or about their diagnosis, as in Ben's case. As we move up the pyramid, we have the opportunity to talk about the causes of events. And frankly, this is exactly where Ben is we can talk to him about his diagnosis and why he has a rigidity in terms of thinking, why he has rules, why he has a certain inflexibility, and where that comes from, and how it can be managed, and what we'll do to support him in terms of managing that. And then that moves right up to the tip of the pyramid. And again, in Ben's case, you know, we talked to him about the diagnosis as well. So the takeaway points here are that many times for a lot of children, we don't ever have to say the word autism. We don't have to discuss the diagnosis on point because it may not be developmentally appropriate from a language standpoint. But you can always talk to that child about very specific events that are occurring, how you're supporting them during those events, and the communication in that way.
Okay, we've moved now to the next slide, which is when to initiate discussions. And again, this is something that really depends on each individual family and their needs and comfort level. Obviously, you know, it's just like you try to decide, when am I going to tell my child about, you know, how he or she was born. You need to look for certain signs of readiness. Is your child able to understand what you may be talking to him or her about? Is your child coming home from school and asking questions? And to that, I have a story to share with you. There was a little boy I was working with. His name was Jacob. He was 6 years old, and I just happened to be in the home when he came home from school that day. And he had a session that day with one of the tutors, and he came home and was having a snack and said to his mom, very matter-of-factly, "Mommy, today I heard my teacher talk about autism, and she said my name. What is autism?" Now, I almost had to pick this mother up off the floor, and I was glad I was there to assist her in how to proceed with this conversation. But typically, if you have a child who has great conversational skills and is able to ask questions and has an awareness, about him or herself, you want to say something before he or she comes home with that question. And I think if there's anything we leave you with today, one of the most important things is that you want to be proactive and initiate this conversation because you have control. You don't want your child to hear something outside of the home when you have no idea how this information is being delivered. So I think, Michael, you want to say something about
that? Yeah, if I can interject there as well. And this is a real carry-away point as well. If a family doesn't take control over the conversation, the child will come in contact with discussion about them, and it'll be very revealing discussion, and it can be very troubling to a child. Because of the work that I do, I spend a lot of time in the community with families. So we're working on skills right within the community. It could be grocery shopping. It could be doing something recreational in nature, such as being at a rock wall. And I have to tell you, more than five times, six times, there have been so many occasions where a person has stopped, for example, in a grocery store, and said to their own child or to their husband or wife, look at that kid. He is autistic. And they say it audibly. They say it so that everybody in the aisle can hear. Mm-hmm. And I find it many times utterly remarkable that a person would take the liberty to have a conversation so obviously in the presence of a child and the presence of that child's family. That has occurred so many times, especially in grocery stores. But it's also occurred in swimming pools. I've taken kids swimming, and I recall one man at a swimming pool telling the dad of a child to take his kid out of the pool because he's autistic, and he'll probably void in the pool and soil it. And this is a conversation that occurs aloud. So what Karen is saying is so absolutely true, that the child will hear communication, will hear descriptions of them, and they will come home with curiosity and confusion and not understanding. So there again, the relevance and the importance of you as a family member taking control, because if you don't, ultimately, somebody in the community that does not have the sensibilities, that does not have the care and compassion for children, will say something. And that becomes very troubling when we have to respond to our children as a result of their questions, as a result of a communication like that.
Yeah, I think, Michael, you pretty much hit on everything that I wanted to talk about with regard to that. Just, you know, it's very important that you take the lead and you set the stage for when and how this conversation will take place.
Okay, we're still on the slide for when to initiate discussions, and I'll often do it when it's very clear to me that a child is having difficulty with communication. For example, I'll use that as an opportunity to let them know how we'll support them. And I may be supporting them by picture-based communication systems, assistive technology. It could be something I'm using on an iPad or an iPhone or an iTouch. And I'll use that opportunity to describe to them exactly why I'm doing it and what I'm trying to achieve. Or if there's difficulties with their own behavioral regulation, one of the things I really like to do with children is to essentially debrief them. So after I've worked or assisted them through a state of it could be extreme or mild behavioral regulation, dysregulation, I will take that opportunity to talk to the child about what kind of supports they require, why I'm doing what I do, why I'm having the teachers that I work with do what they do. It becomes yet another opportunity. So as Karen has already pointed out, this is a dynamic process. We are looking for opportunities proactively and opportunities reactively to discuss with the child the support that they need and the challenges that they have. And once again, the language that we use got to be developmentally appropriate. It's got to match up with who they are from a receptive and expressive standpoint, and we have these conversations dynamically.
Michael, I just want to add one other thing with regard to when to initiate a discussion. As with any situation within a family, it's always easier to tell your child something when they're younger rather than they're older. You don't want your child to be 18 and say, well, why didn't you tell me this sooner? And it also becomes more of a natural part of who they are and how they're growing up to hear words and phrases and to have an understanding of their challenges and their strengths, you know, just in terms of who they are as an individual. So the earlier you start, the easier it will be to add on to that information as your child grows and develops.
And taking off on Karen's point in terms of development, I'm going to take that opportunity to advance to the next slide, and that's how to discuss autism. And implications of theory of mind. From a developmental standpoint, and now I'm talking about children with good language capacity and good reciprocity, good back and forth in terms of conversation. Theory of mind, simply put, is the ability to understand other people's perspectives and to take perspective and to be able to articulate varying perspectives. So I want to go back to Ben for a second. I'm going to tell you the rest of that story. Ben was a person that texted me, and then we ended up having a phone conversation. I asked Ben to share with me. He said that he wanted to have a 1 hour and 4 minute conversation. And I said to Ben, I don't know if you know, but I'm in my office, and it's a day of the week where I work. And I said to him, what do you think the feasibility is? And that's a word that he understands. What do you think the likelihood is that I could talk for that long? And he immediately said, probably not. And I said, why? You know, why do you think that I can't spend that much time on the phone? And he said, because you've got other things to do. You've got meetings to go to and people and other children that you have to visit. And I said, that is exactly right. That's exactly right. So there's an example of Ben, you know, moving away from what he wanted in terms of his own rule about how long a conversation would occur, and he moved into perspective taking. So the point here is that from a proactive standpoint, we teach, Karen and I, teach perspective taking, because once we get to the child, once we get to the point where the child is doing the perspective taking, it becomes much easier for us to have a substantive conversation with them when the time comes. The other thing that I do very frequently is that I get children to take perspective about a situation that does not involve them. So it's often the case that I will pull up YouTube videos, for example, and I really like the graininess of the YouTube video. I like the authenticity, the realness of YouTube videos. And I'll say to a child, let's watch this together, and now you tell me, you know, what you think that child's idea is in terms of what's going on, and what do you think the idea is of other people in terms of what's going on. And there's one adorable video that I watch often. It's a boy who is been encouraged to go to a dance recital, and he's sitting in the middle of a dance floor, and he just is crying, and he just definitely and obviously does not want to be there. So that's the kind of video that I'll view with the child. We'll do perspective taking. What do you think that kid's thinking? What do you think his mom's thinking? What do you think his dad's thinking? And I'll get the perspective taking to occur under non-emotional conditions, because we're talking about somebody else. We're talking about a third person, and it has nothing to do with the child and the individual that I'm talking to. So I use theory of mind. I teach perspective taking. I will do that under non-emotional conditions to build a foundation for substantive conversation later on. And I can advance to the next slide and tell you about the resources that Karen and I use for teaching theory of mind, because it goes beyond the scope of this webinar. But teaching children to mind read is one. The theory of mind coach is another one that I find very, very helpful. And then just generally narrative-based intervention, which is an evidence-based practice. And, of course, Carol Gray's social stories as well. It does go beyond the scope of this presentation and webinar to discuss the particulars of theory of mind, but it's essential in terms of building that foundation for children.
And now we're on the next slide. How often? How often do you have this conversation with your child? And I think Michael already made a very important contribution with regard to this topic. As often, you need to have it often, as often as is necessary. You'll see throughout your day-to-day life that opportunities will occur naturally. Something will come up, and, you know, you'll be able to talk about it with regard to, you know, what's going on with your child and his or her diagnosis. It's important to have the conversation often. It's important to repeat it, just as you would with anything else that's going on in your family, whether it be a medical condition, a divorce, a death in the family. It's important to have the conversation, and as your child gets older, the conversation will progress to different levels. And one other thing I just wanted to add that I have been told by families is very helpful is, you know, we understand, obviously Michael and I deal with this, you know, every single day, and we work with families who ask us, you know, how and when do I tell my child that he or she has autism. One of the things that we have found is very helpful is if you need to, just go ahead and practice it, rehearse it. You know, you can do some role playing with your partner, with a friend, with anyone you need to. If you need to, just do it in front of the mirror. Because again, the important thing is that you want to be comfortable. You know what? This is who your child is. And it's important that he or she understands it and that they understand it from a place that comes from compassion and love and support. And you will find that once you do this, you will be relieved, great, great relief, and it won't be any big deal. The families that report back to me that took my suggestions and used some of the words that we've used here today in our conversation with you, say it was no big deal. And, you know, we had a conversation, and right after the conversation, he wanted to know if he could watch his favorite TV show. And, you know, it really isn't a big deal. It's as big a deal as you decide to make it. And toward that end, if you talk about it more frequently, especially when it you know, comes up naturally, you'll find that it's just that much easier, and it won't be any big deal.
I'm just going to make some closing comments and just outline the points we'd like you to think about as we end this webinar. But the first one is family agreement and just really having a conversation with critical family members, whether it be, you know, your husband, your wife, your partner, your companion, also your other children, extended family members, grandmother, grandfather, for example, just really coming to agreement that this is what will be done, because it really is a family unit and it's a family set of circumstances, and no one individual really takes on the decision to do this, but there's got to be conversation. The next point I'd like to make is I really encourage you to take control over these conversations, because if you don't, somebody in the community will. It will occur at school, it will occur on the playground, it will occur in a restaurant, it will occur at a swimming pool. It's inevitable. It will happen. So I'd much rather see you as a family member taking control and responsibility before the child ends up hearing conversation elsewhere by somebody that's not as caring or doesn't have the sensibilities that you do. The third point is just look for naturally occurring circumstances and make this a dynamic process. And then also being really mindful of the threshold, never going too long with the conversation. Just look for the signs and the indicators that the conversation's done. You'll move on. You'll come back to it at a later time. If your child has the readiness skills, teaching theory of mind and perspective taking will support this lifelong understanding of what their challenges are. So there's some great curricula that are available, some great resources. Feel free to contact us or to look at the resources that Karen and I outlined on the slide. And then finally, the thing I'd like to end with, always, always emphasize your child's strengths, who they are as people away from the diagnosis of autism, what makes you smile, what makes you laugh, what makes you love them, constantly pointing out their strengths. It's a balance here. We thank you for participating and for your attention and wish you well with these conversations.
Thank you, and the best of luck to you.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Our first question, this session provided me with support to talk about autism with a person diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. If your answer is strongly agree, press star 1. Agree, press star 2. Disagree, star 3. Or strongly disagree, star 4. And we'll pause for just a moment. Our next question. This session educated me on when to initiate a conversation about the diagnosis of autism. Star 1 if you strongly agree, star 2 if you agree, star 3 disagree, or star 4 strongly disagree. And we'll pause to collect your responses. And moving on, overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Strongly agree, star 1. Agree, star 2. Disagree, star 3. Or strongly disagree, star 4. And question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. If you agree, press star 1. If you do not agree, press star 2. And our final question, please select the response that best describes your role in life of an individual with autism. Excuse me, in your role in the life of an individual with autism. Star 1 if you are the parent of a child with autism. Star 2 if you are a family member of a child with autism. Or star 3 for other. And thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, please press star 1 on your phone line and you'll have your phone line opened into the conference. Also, if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question. I have no questions at this time, but I'd like to remind everyone it's star 1 to ask a question. And I do have a question. I'll open that line.
Hi, I have a question.
Hello.
Hi. I was really glad when I saw the seminar come up because this has been a long question on our minds of when to tell our son. He's 9. He was diagnosed at age 2, and he's high-functioning, and he no longer needs services anymore. At school, since he was 8, he stopped getting services because they couldn't find anything else for him to work on. He's doing so well. But my question is, do we still talk to him about this? I mean, I'm getting the indication after listening to the seminar, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Karen,
go ahead. Oh.
Yeah, Karen and I are both kind of leaning our heads right into the speaker at the same time. You know, the autism never goes away. You know, many children, and I'm glad to hear your story. You know, it's integrated, and your child obviously is doing very, very well. But if you know, there's got to be things that you continue to see, or let me just reframe that. I'll ask the question: are there that you continue to see? You know, that are still, yeah. So for that reason, you know, definitely still having the conversations and again, emphasizing his strengths and man, he's overcome some obstacles already and just, you know, pointing. You know, I used to do something with my own son. You know, we'd go for walks and I'd say, Josh, I got 10 things I want to tell you about what I love about you. And I would do that. And you can do the same thing because your son, I think it's your son, has overcome a lot of, you know, a lot of challenges already. Remind him of that, but also talk about, you know, those things that remain.
Also, one other thing I wanted to add is it's important that he have this information about himself because one day he may decide to have children of his own. And you don't want to tell him when he's in his, you know, 20s or 30s, oh, by the way, when you were little, you had a diagnosis of autism. So, again, it's more comfortable to talk about it now than, you know, to have to provide this information later on in life. And I think the way...
He's already really hard on himself anyway, at home anyway. And I know he's in class with low-functioning autistic kids, and he came home one day and said, I learned about autism today, and here's what autistic kids are. And, you know, I didn't say anything. You know, now looking back, I should have.
Well, you can refer back to that conversation. You can say, you know what, remember I was thinking about something. Remember that day you came home and you told me about some of the other kids in your class and you told me all about autism? And then you can lead into it. And, again, I would do the positive approach that Michael talked about and constantly remind him how far he's come and how much progress he's made and that will continue. And, you know, one thing I tell parents about kids who have made the kind of progress that it sounds like your son has is you want to make sure they know that autism isn't like a cold. They're not going to get it again. There may be things from their past that they're challenged with that will come up in different ways as they grow, but it's not like they're going to go back to, let's say, not being able to have a conversation or something like that, or having a tantrum again as a means of communicating. So I would definitely, you know, he provided you with a great open door. You can use that as an entry into this conversation and just make sure you focus on lots of positive strengths that he has, including his ability to overcome as much as he has.
Yeah, if I could just add one more thing here. The reason to talk about it, I'm just reminded when I was a college professor, I had a lot of students from the library science program come to me who had Asperger's syndrome. And one of the things they told me in conversations that they, you know, they wish people had talked to them about relationships and what was going to happen, you know, in high school and what was going to happen when I got in college. And, you know, I wish those conversations would have occurred all along. So that's just from the perspective of an individual that was a college student. And you know, that was very meaningful to me, and I heard that very clearly. So you'll make your own decisions. We wish you, you know, the best in terms of those communications and conversations with your son.
Well, and I think, too, is the labels, you know, it's another fear is because he's got friends, he's in sports, and he's, you know, popular, and, you know, to have that taken away from him, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, you know, you will definitely make your own decision and you know, do that in the context of your family. But, you know, every kid, even with the label, is so, so different. And I think that's one of the things you really have to emphasize is that just because that label's there, you know, he's not like other children necessarily with the same diagnosis. You know, there's no model of a kid with the diagnosis. And really emphasizing, you know, what his strengths are and how he's challenged by it. You'll make your decisions, and we wish you the best with that.
Just one other thing I want to add for you and for anyone else who's struggling with this whole label issue. You know, autism is a spectrum, and you can always say to your son, just like you can get a really bad cold or you can get a mild cold, autism comes in different levels. Yours, luckily, was very mild, and look at how much progress you've made. So if that makes it easier for you, you know, you can try that approach. You can think about that and... Was there another question?
Once again, it is star one if you have a question today. I do have one more question. I'll open that line.
Hi. Similar to the question before, but a little bit different. I have a son who's 12, and we have an appointment in a couple weeks for an evaluation to test for, like, high-functioning Asperger's. Would you recommend the conversation to talk to him about it similar to this, you know, discussing the strengths and, you know, how much we'll support him? Because I see high school looming in his future, and I just think there's so much we need to do to help him be successful. So that's kind of why we're exploring this route.
I do think it's a good idea to explain to him what kind of evaluation he's going to have. And you don't need to use labels at this point. I don't know, Michael, you may have a different, no, he's sticking his head in agreement with me, because
okay.
You don't know what the evaluation will bring. But instead, you can talk about his strengths. You know, these are things that you're really great at and you're really good at and I really enjoy about you, or your friends really enjoy about you, or you enjoy about yourself. And these are some of the things you struggle with. And so we just want to get a better picture of what's going on and how we can help you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's excellent, Karen. And one of the things I would say is, you know, telling your child that you are going for an evaluation, and you know you're looking to find out, you know, what the challenges are, what the strengths are, and that you commit to sharing any communication you have with the doctors with him.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, that's a promise you'll make as his mom. And you'll talk about that. But Karen's absolutely right. You don't know yet, but do commit to letting him know why you're going for an evaluation in terms of understanding his strengths and capabilities and challenges, and that you'll share information with him as it comes to you.
And that it's a way to help and support him.
Great. I appreciate that.
Good luck.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
This is Lauren again with the Autism Team. It looks like we're about 5 minutes over the hour, so we aren't able to take any more questions, but I do want to thank you all so much for attending, and thank you, Dr. Cameron and Dr. Conway, for providing such wonderful insights to us today. Again, if you have questions about therapies discussed today, please contact the Autism Team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please be sure to mark your calendars to join our next Autism Awareness Seminar next March 14th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, when we will be discussing assistive technology, state of the science. Thank you and have a great day.
And that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you all for your participation.